Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are coming to the very end of the 11th canto this morning, a section of the Uddhava Gita. And in this class we'll be seeing some of the contrasts and similarities between the Uddhava Gita and the Bhagavad Gita. We do have a lot of jumping around to do on the verses, so somebody very adept kindly handle the keyboard. So there are 27 some chapters of Bhagavad Gita, Uddhava Gita. And we're going to deal with four of them this morning, chapters 23 through 26. Thank you, Nanda Kumar Prabhu, for stepping in on short notice to cover chapters 19 through 22 yesterday. And in chapter 22, at the very end, Krishna mentions to Uddhava, as the two of them are speaking, how important it is for a person to be able to tolerate criticism from other people. You know the expression, having a thin skin? So it means that if somebody criticizes us, we become very affected and depressed or angry, or in other ways have some reaction. So Krishna mentions this in passing, and then Uddhava asks him to explain it more fully. So in response, he begins chapter 23, which is the Song of the Avanti Brahman. Now, here's one contrast with the Bhagavad Gita, that in the course of the 18 chapters of Bhagavad Gita, offhand I can think of just one place where Krishna refers to an historical personality as an example of one of his points. Can anyone remember where that is? Janak, right, he refers to Janak Maharaj as somebody who was exemplary in doing his duty. But in the Uddhava Gita, he goes through at least three or more, actually more examples told in the form of stories, historical narrations. Can anyone think of one of them that we have read? Yes, where Krishna is making a point, and then he cites some personality from history. Brahman is coming. Yeah, the Brahman. Yes, the Avdut. Yes, Avdut. There's another one. Pardon me? King Yadu. Yes. Yadu actually. Yadu and the Brahman. That's one past him. But what about Pingala? That's included in that story. Okay, but still Krishna aside. So we're going to cover two such instances where Krishna is giving a very detailed example. So the first is this Avanti Brahman. Yes, the theme is that how one is enjoined to tolerate the criticisms of other people. Okay? So now, since we have a lot to cover this morning, for the sake of brevity, kindly hold your questions till the end. Just jot them down that way. So we can cover everything in time, and we will adjust according to the amount of time allowed for questions. So this Avanti Brahman is cited by Krishna as the example of tolerance. This is the theme of chapter 23. So this Avanti Brahman, of course, generally Brahmins are not engaged in business, but in this case, this particular Brahmin was a businessman as well. And he was a very, very cheap businessman. He would collect his money and just hoard it. He would not give it to his family. He wouldn't give it in charity. He would even make his own body suffer rather than spend money. As a result, his family detested him, and as a result of not offering any money in charity, the demigods began withholding their blessings. So he started to lose all of his hard-earned money, and it's thieves started taking it. His family members started stealing it. Providence worked against him. And all of a sudden, this man to whom money meant everything was without money. And his family completely rejected him. Nobody wanted anything to do with him. In that very morose state of mind, he had a very profound realization that left him feeling very deeply detached from the whole affair. So on Kusha, if you go through verses 14 through 23, chapter 23, the Song of the Avanti Brahman, 14. Avanti, by the way, is famous in Krishna Leela for what? The town of Avanti. It's Ujjain, yes. It's in modern India, it's Ujjain. Pardon me? No, not well, Sudama is associated with it. Who is headquartered there? Sandipani Muni. So Krishna went to school there. And after killing Kamsa, he went to Avanti to study at Sandipani Muni school. And this Brahmin is also from there. So Avanti is historically a very famous place of high learning. So anyway, this Brahmin now expresses his renunciation as follows. Do we have a mic? Okay. So somebody besides Ankush, kindly get the mic. It's over here. Yeah, Ankush, you need to run the board. Thank you. Okay, the Brahmin spoke as follows. Oh, what great misfortune. I have simply tormented myself uselessly, struggling so hard for money that was not even intended for religiosity or material enjoyment.
Generally, the wealth of misers never allows them any happiness. In this life, it causes their self-torment, and when they die, it sends them to hell.
Whatever pure fame is possessed by the famous, and whatever praiseworthy qualities are found in the virtuous, are destroyed by even a small amount of greed, just as one's attractive physical beauty is ruined by a trace of white leprosy.
In the earning, attainment, increase, protection, expense, loss, and enjoyment of wealth, all men experience great labor, fear, anxiety, and delusion.
Theft, violence, speaking lies, duplicity, lust, anger, perplexity, pride, quarreling, enmity, faithlessness, envy, and the dangers caused by women, gambling, and intoxication are the 15 undesirable qualities that contaminate men because of greed for wealth. Although these qualities are undesirable, men falsely ascribe value to them. When desiring to achieve the real benefit of life, should therefore remain aloof from undesirable material wealth.
Even a man's brother's wife, parents, and friends united with him in love will immediately break off their affectionate relationships and become enemies over a single coin.
For even a small amount of money, these relatives and friends become very agitated and their anger is inflamed. Acting as rivals, they quickly give up all sentiments of goodwill and will reject one at a moment's notice, even to the point of committing murder.
Those who obtain human life, which is prayed for even by the demigods, and in that of the human birth become situated as first-class brahmanas, are extremely fortunate. If they disregard this important opportunity, they are certainly killing their own self-interest and thus achieve a most unfortunate end.
What mortal man, having achieved this human life, which is the very gate to both heaven and liberation, would willingly become attached to that above of worthlessness, material property?
Very good. So that is the speech of the Brahmin in renunciation. So he goes on then to become very renounced. This has a profound effect on him, and he says, okay, I'm just giving up any kind of attachment whatsoever to the things of this world. And if you go on then to verse 31. So, with his mind thus determined, that most excellent Avanti Brahman was able to untie the knots of desire within his heart. He then assumed the role of a peaceful and silent sannyasi mendicant. He wandered about the earth, keeping his intelligence, senses, and life here under control. To beg charity, he traveled alone to various cities and villages. He did not advertise his advanced spiritual position, and thus was not recognized by others.
O kind Uddhava, seeing him as an old, dirty beggar, rowdy persons would dishonor him with many insults.
Some of these persons would take away his sannyasi rod, and some the water pot which he was using as a begging bowl. Some took his deerskin seat, some his chanting beads, and some would steal his torn, ragged clothing. Displaying these things before him, they would pretend to offer them back, but would then hide them again.
When he was sitting on the bank of a river about to partake of the food that he had collected by his begging, such sinful rascals would come and pass urine on it, and they would dare to spit on his head.
Although he had taken a vow of silence, they would try to make him speak, and if he did not speak, they would beat him with sticks. Others would chastise him, saying, "This man is just a thief," and others would bind him up with rope, shouting, "Tie him up, tie him up."
They would criticize and insult him, saying, "This man is just a hypocrite and a cheat. He makes a business of religion simply because he lost all his wealth and his family threw him out."
Some would ridicule him by saying, "Just see this greatly
powerful
sage." I can't see.
He's steadfast as the Himalaya mountain. By practice of silence, he strives for his goal with great determination, just like a duck. Other person would pass foul air upon him, and sometimes others who would bind this twice-born Brahmana in chains and keep him captive like a pet animal.
The Brahmana understood that all his suffering from other living beings from the higher forces of nature and from his own body was unavoidable, being allotted to him by providence.
And one more.
Even while being insulted by these low-class men for trying to effect his downfall, he remained steady in his spiritual duties. Fixing his resolution in the mills of goodness, he began to chant the following song.
So here, the Brahmin goes through all the possible things that could be causing his suffering very systematically, and he explains why everyone is not responsible. So here's the first.
Brahmin said, "These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. Neither are the demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work or time. Rather, it is the mind alone that causes happiness and distress and perpetuates the rotation of material life."
Now he's going to elaborate on each one of these. People, demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work or time. Why they are individually not responsible for his distress. We'll just read the first one here. No, that's all right. I'll just summarize them because they're a bit technical but very interesting. He says, of course, other people do not cause our own distress. They can do whatever they want. It's just how we react to it. Then he gives the example: if a person bites his own tongue, is somebody else responsible for that suffering? So that's in regard to people. Then as far as the gods, he said, the gods are not responsible for my suffering. They are in charge of the activities of my senses. Now, this is one of the nice descriptions of the creation in the Bhagavatam. There are demigods in charge of all of our senses and sensual activities. So the senses of his body are being controlled by the gods. If he's suffering, is that the fault of the gods? They're just interacting with the senses. And then he compares it to a person beating himself. If, if a person strikes himself with his arm, is somebody else responsible for that suffering? So the arms and the demigods are compared like that. Then he says, my suffering caused just by the fact that I am a soul? And the soul is one with everything. So he gives the impersonal argument and says, if the soul is one with everything, then everything, if I am actually God, in other words, then everything is an illusion. And so this anger that I'm feeling is also an illusion. So therefore, he rejects it on that basis. My soul is not responsible. The planets are not responsible for my suffering. Expert astrologers, he said, know that the planets are always fighting each other. So if they're fighting each other and I'm suffering as a result, and I'm suffering, they're fighting each other, I cannot be affected by it because I am an eternal soul. So their fighting may be affecting my body, but it doesn't really affect me as a soul. So therefore the planets are not responsible, he says, rejecting astrology. And my own karma, he said, is not responsible for my suffering. Let's turn to verse 50. I believe that's the explanation for that one. Then a little further, please. Keep going. There we go. If we assume that fruitive work is the cause of happiness and distress, we are still not dealing with the soul. The idea of material work arises when there is a spiritual actor who is conscious and a material body that undergoes the work, the transformation of happiness and distress as a reaction to such work. Since the body has no life, it cannot be the actual recipient of happiness and distress, nor can the soul, who is ultimately completely spiritual and aloof from the material body. Since karma thus has no ultimate basis in either the body or soul, at whom can one become angry? Hold your questions. Write it down. Okay, and then finally, the idea of time. He says, in essence, that time is created by God and the soul is created by God. So the spark cannot be burned by the fire. Since they're both creations of God. So whom will I get angry at? The soul has been created by God, time's been created by God, so whom am I supposed to get angry at over my suffering? These are his very thorough and systematic arguments. Okay, and again, time prohibits us. You can study them in more detail if you like. But he just goes through all of them as part of this song. So then if you turn to verse 57, this is where he gives his conclusion. Since there is no other cause of suffering except for my own past activities, my own decisions, I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nescience by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord, Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So you kindly put up the Sanskrit for this verse. This verse is very well known because it expresses the conclusion of his renunciation. Okay? And this, does anyone know the particular noteworthy feature of this Sanskrit verse? It is chanted by at least all of our ISKCON sannyasis as part of their Gayatri mantra. This is called a sannyas mantra, a renunciation mantra. So let's chant it once ourselves, shall we? A couple times. Etam saastaya paratmanishtam adyasitam purvatamayar maharshibi aham tarishyami durantaparam tamo mudungangris nisevayaiva. And again the translation. Together, please. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nescience by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord, Paramatma, Supreme Personality of Godhead. And purport, please. This verse is quoted by Krishna Das Kaviraj in his Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 3.6.
Srila Prabhupada comments as follows. In connection with this verse, which is a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that of the 64 items required for rendering devotional service, acceptance of the symbolic marks of sannyas is a regulative principle. If one accepts the sannyas order, his main business is to devote his life completely to the service of Mukunda, Krishna. If one does not completely devote his mind and body to the service of the Lord, he does not actually become a sannyasi. It is not simply a matter of changing dress. In Bhagavad Gita 6.1, it is also stated, Anashkrita karma phalam karyam karma karoti yaha sa sannyasi cha yogi cha.
Go ahead.
One who works devotedly for the satisfaction of Lord Krishna is a sannyasi. The dress is not sannyas, but the attitude of service to Krishna is.
Yes, very important verse from Bhagavad Gita. So one who works as one is obliged is actually in the renounced order, not one who gives up everything. That's the essence of this verse from the sixth chapter. So that is the song of the Avanti Brahmin, chapter 23. Okay, let's go on to chapter 24 now, please. So after describing this story to illustrate how one should be aloof from the criticisms of others by knowledge and by understanding how one is a soul and not affected by all the material things going around outside of one, Krishna goes on to give a technical explanation of the creation of all of this external stuff. Okay, so this is a Sankhya section. This is explained in many other places in Srimad Bhagavatam. But one of the interesting features in this particular explanation that Krishna gives is found in verses 22 through 27, if you kindly turn over there. He explains, first of all, how material nature is created as ingredient. Okay, it is the ingredient cause of everything we see. Just a brief explanation of what this means. If you take clay and make it into a pot, then you have the ingredient clay, which has now been transformed into some useful product. And when that product is finished and is broken down, again it becomes clay. So the ingredients of the material world are the same all the way through. They're ingredients before they're manifest and they're ingredients after they're manifest. But when they're manifest, we see the products and not so much the ingredient. So in understanding Sankhya, this intellectual understanding of creation, this is one of the principles to recognize that this energy all exists as unmanifested stuff. Then it becomes stuff, and then it goes back into being unmanifested again. Okay? So in summary, this is the whole process of creation of the material world. These energies exist as separated inferior energies of Krishna, then they come into vision by some engineering, and then they go back into their unmanifest state. So he describes that Krishna describes to Uddhava that when the Supreme Lord looks at this unmanifested energy, then it becomes impregnated with all of the living entities. And then in order to fulfill all of the pending desires of all these living entities, it takes shape as the three modes of material nature, or the three qualities of goodness, passion, and ignorance. And then the three modes of nature cover the living entity, he says, spiritually and materially. In other words, the living entity who is thus conditioned is completely surrounded and by these modes of nature, which are manifested from false ego. So the living entity is thinking, this is all my creation. So let's read here. All of this takes place. The next chapter is about the modes. But this is, after all of this is set up, and executed, then it goes in reverse. So I don't recall seeing this elsewhere in Bhagavatam. This is very interesting. Creation in reverse, when it's all being wound up again back into the unmanifest state. So who's up for reading?
At the time of annihilation, the mortal body of the living being becomes merged into food. The food merges into the grains, and the grain merges back into the earth. The earth merges into its subtle sensation, fragrance. The fragrance merges into water, and water further merges into its own quality, taste. The taste merges into fire, which merges into form. The form merges into touch, and touch merges into ether. Ether finally merges into the sensation of sound. The senses all merge into their own origins, the presiding demigods, and they, O gentle Uddhava, merge into the controlling mind, which itself merges into false ego in the mode of goodness. Sound becomes one with the false ego in the mode of ignorance, and all-powerful false ego, the first of all the physical elements, merges into the total nature. The total material nature, the primary repository of the three basic modes, dissolves into the modes. These modes of the nature then merges into the unmanifest form of nature, and that unmanifest form merges into time. Time merges into the Supreme Lord, present in the form of the omniscient Mahapurusha, the original activator of the living beings. That origin of all life merges into me, the unborn Supreme Soul, who remains alone established within himself.
Phew. Okay. You got all that? This will all be on the test. So this is creation in reverse. Everything just folds right back into itself. Very interesting description. So let's go on next to chapter 20. So chapter 25. Next chapter, yes. The three modes of nature and beyond. So this chapter deals with the subject which is dealt with in which chapter of Bhagavad Gita? 14. The three modes of material nature. There are a lot of similarities in it, and some very refreshing differences. One of the differences you'll find here is that in the Gita, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives descriptions of many different things according to the three modes. But in this chapter, you'll find that he gives four descriptions pertaining to the modes. Anyone know what the fourth is? There's goodness, passion, ignorance, and what? Yeah, pure goodness or transcendence. Right. Yes. So, as an example, he says, to live in the forest is in the mode of goodness. To live in the city is in the mode of passion. To live in the gambling house is in the mode of ignorance. But to live where I reside is transcendental. So, in several examples of the modes in this chapter, we find this fourth option. But right in the beginning, in verses 2 through 5, there are some very nice descriptions of the three modes. So I'm going to do a little exercise here. There are 10 or 15 items for each of the mode of ignorance, mode of passion, and mode of goodness. So what I'd like to do is read them one by one, mode by mode, together. And I'm going to go around and ask everyone very quickly, you tell me tell us all which is the trait that you'd either most like to obtain or most like to get rid of. Okay? Why don't we start with the mode of ignorance just to work up? Okay, so let's see. Scroll down a bit, Ankush. Okay. Everyone can see, please read this together. Intolerant anger, stinginess, speaking without scriptural authority, violent hatred, living as a parasite, hypocrisy, chronic fatigue, quarrel, lamentation, delusion, unhappiness, depression, sleeping too much, false expectations, fear and laziness constitute the major qualities of the mode of ignorance. Okay? All right, pick one out. Which is the one you most like to get rid of? If you don't want to say anything, just wave me off, okay?
I would like to get rid of my habit of sleeping too much.
Yeah, chronic fatigue.
Yeah, sleeping too much.
Everything.
Intolerant anger.
Being a parasite.
Fear. Delusion.
I was going to say the parasite as well.
Fear.
Sleeping too much.
Sleeping too much.
Intolerant anger.
Hypocrisy.
I'm thinking I could be a little more stingy. Maybe that way I'd have more money.
Lamentation and delusion.
Intolerant anger.
Everyone try to follow along here. We've got intolerant anger. Okay.
Hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
Stinginess, hypocrisy, and...
Just one. Unhappiness. Unhappiness.
Fear.
Fear.
Laziness.
Intolerant anger.
False expectations.
Yes. False expectations.
Okay. Very good. Okay, these are ones we want to get rid of. Passion. Now let's read... let's now read passion. Scroll up a little bit, please. Yes, starting with material desire, great endeavor, audacity, dissatisfaction, even in gain, false pride, praying for material advancement, considering oneself different and better than others, sense gratification, rash eagerness to fight, a fondness for hearing oneself praised, the tendency to ridicule others, advertising one's own prowess, and justifying one's actions by one's strength, because I said so, are qualities of the mode of passion. Okay. Okay, which one of these would you most like to get rid of?
Considering oneself different and better than others.
False pride.
All of those.
Different and better.
All of those, yeah. Rash eagerness to fight.
Material desire.
A fondness for praise, hearing oneself praise.
Justifying one's own actions by one's strength and quality.
Different and better than others.
False pride.
Material desire.
Dissatisfaction even in gain.
Dissatisfaction even in gain.
Dissatisfaction even in gain.
False pride.
Advertising prowess.
False pride.
Sense gratification.
Dissatisfaction even in gain.
Fondness for hearing oneself praised.
Sense gratification.
Great endeavor for material cause.
Considering oneself different. Material desire.
Good, okay. Is anyone keeping score here? Okay. And finally, now let's end on this uplifting note. Which quality of the mode of goodness would you most like to embody and obtain? Let's read these together. Mind and sense control, tolerance, discrimination, sticking to one's prescribed duty, truthfulness, mercy, careful study of past and future, satisfaction in any condition, generosity, renunciation of sense gratification, faith in the spiritual master, being embarrassed at improper action, charity, simplicity, humbleness, and satisfaction within oneself are the qualities of the mode of goodness. Which one of those tops your list is something you'd really like to experience?
Careful study of past and future.
Being embarrassed in proper action.
Satisfaction within oneself.
Mind and sense control.
Satisfaction in any condition.
Faith in the spiritual master.
Satisfaction within oneself.
Mind and sense control.
Study of past and future.
Satisfaction in any condition.
Mind and sense control.
Mercy.
Faith in spiritual master.
Faith in the spiritual master.
Mind and sense control.
Humbleness.
All of them.
Humbleness.
Satisfaction in any condition.
Tolerance.
Mind and self-control.
Mind and sense-control.
Ditto.
Humbleness.
Truthfulness.
Sticking to one's prescribed duty.
Mind and sense-control.
Okay. I guess mind and sense-control won that round. Okay, so you can see this is the same information we find in Chapter 14, but presented in a different way and very interesting. So this chapter 25 deals with the topic of the modes from a very refreshing point of view. Okay, good. Now finally we'll end on chapter 26. If you kindly go over there, go to verse 7. This is the story of Puru Rava. So after describing how the modes of nature affect the living being, Krishna goes on to tell Uddhava that how important it is to become transcendental of their influence, to their influence. And to illustrate this point, he tells the story of Puru Rava, King Puru Rava, who is described in more detail in the ninth canto, which we will read in about a month. Yes, Ayla. Ayla. So this chapter is called the Ayla Gita. And again, just like Pingala or the Avanti Brahman, Krishna gives this person as an example of somebody who became detached by circumstance. So his story is very interesting. Of course, Puru Rava has this history in his family. There was a big fight between Soma, who's the god of the moon, and also drugs, and Brihaspati, who's the spiritual master of the demigods. Anyone read 1984 by Aldous Huxley? You remember? So in that book, they give they give people Soma, right? And they take Soma holidays. When you get a break from work, they drug you up and you just imagine you're somewhere. So this is called Soma. So Soma is the god of the drugs as well as the moon god. And he became attracted to Brihaspati's wife, whose name was Tara. So he kidnapped Tara, and Brihaspati was quite offended, and they had a big war. This is always going on in the heavenly planets, this kind of stuff. So the demigods sided and took various sides. Lord Shiva took the side of Soma. Lord Indra took the side of Brihaspati. They had a huge fight, and finally Tara was returned to her husband, Brihaspati. Shortly thereafter, she was found to be pregnant. So it was unclear how she had become pregnant. Then when the child was born, it was this beautiful golden little boy. And both Brihaspati and Soma wanted the child. So they had another big fight over this child, whose name was Buddha. Not with double D, but Buddha. Buddha. So I believe Narada took Tara to a quiet place and said, okay, who is the father of this child? And she said, it is Soma. So Soma became the father of this Buddha. And I guess he got custody in court. That was, but Buddha's son, in turn, became the father of this Puru Rava. So he had some family history of marital discord. And Puru Rava was a very powerful and famous king. So powerful that his glories and descriptions were even recounted in the heavenly planets. So there in the heavenly planets, this beautiful celestial damsel named Uravasi heard about him. And just hearing about him became very attractive. Who is this Puru Rava? So she had been cursed to have the desires of a human being, even though she was a celestial. So as a result, she came to earth and approached Puru Rava, who immediately became infatuated with her. And almost on the spot, they agreed, why don't we hook up? So it's described that when a woman is more qualified than a man, the man who she is married to or connected with, this is not so desirable. If a woman is equally or less qualified, that's better. So in this case, Urvasi was far superior to Puru Rava by her position. But she agreed, out of her attraction for him, to become his wife under certain conditions. First of all, everything she ate had to be cooked in ghee. No olive oil, okay? And and what to speak of other oils. And she brought with her two celestial calves, little lambs. And Puru Rava had to agree to protect these lambs. That was another condition. And finally she said, and I must never see you undressed except at intimate times. Otherwise, I should never see you undressed. And because such a thing would never be done on the heavenly planets. No, it's something very animalistic going around without clothing that might happen on Earth, very low, low-class people. But it would never happen on the heavenly planets. So she said, this would be another condition. So he agreed to all three conditions. And they enjoyed a very passionate relationship for some time. So Indra was missing Urvasi in the heavenly planets. So he sent some Gandharvas to try to get her back. And so they stole the lambs, and Urvasi heard it. She heard in the dead of night these Gandharvas taking the lambs. And so she said to Puru Rava, what are you, a eunuch? I thought I had a husband here who was going to protect me. Just like that, she woke him up. And so Puru Rava, being stung by her words, jumped out of bed, of course completely undressed, and went running after the lambs. So when he caught the lambs, he came back, Urvasi was gone. So he's very heartbroken to lose her. And this is where we pick up the Aila Gita, the song of Puru Rava, the poignant lamentation that he's expressing upon losing his beloved. But he also, just like Pingala, what was Pingala's frustration, the prostitute? What was her frustration? She couldn't get any customer. And what was the Avanti Brahmin's frustration? Lost all his money. So again, the same theme is repeated three times here in the Uddhava Gita, that somebody has something they want and loses it, gets the benediction of a very deep realization. And so here's the realization of King Puru Rava, or Aila. King Aila said, alas, just see the extent of my delusion. This goddess was embracing me and held my neck in her grip. My heart was so polluted by lust that I had no idea how my life was passing.
That lady cheated me so much that I did not even see the rising or setting of the sun. Alas, for so many years I passed my days in vain. I think I'll just crawl up a bit.
Alas, although I'm supposed to be a mighty emperor, yeah, the crown jewel of all kings of this earth, just see how my bewilderment has rendered me a toy animal in the hands of women.
Yeah. Although I was a powerful lord with a great opulence, that woman gave me up as if I were no more than an insignificant blade of grass. And still, naked and without shame, I followed her, crying out to her like a madman.
Where are my so-called great influence, power, and sovereignty? Just like an ass being kicked in the face by his she-ass, I ran after that woman who had already given me up.
What is the use of big education or practice of austerities and renunciation? And what is the use of studying religious scriptures, of living in solitude and silence, if after all, one's mind is stolen by a woman?
To hell with me. I'm such a fool that I didn't even know what was good for me, although I arrogantly thought I was highly intelligent. Although I achieved the exalted position of a lord, I allowed myself to be conquered by women as if I were a bullock or a jackass.
Even after I had served the so-called nectar of the lips of Urvashi for so many years, my lusty desires kept rising again and again within my heart and were never satisfied, just like a fire that can never be extinguished by the oblations of ghee poured into its flames.
Who but the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who
who lies beyond the material perception and is the Lord of self-satisfied sages, can possibly save my consciousness, which has been stolen by a prostitute?
Because I allowed my intelligence to become dull and because I failed to control my senses, the great confusion in my mind did not go away, even though Urvashi herself gave me wise counsel with well-spoken words.
How can I blame her for my trouble when I myself am ignorant of my real spiritual nature? I did not control my senses, and so I am like a person who mistakenly sees a harmless rope as a snake.
What is this polluted body anyway, so filthy and full of bad odors? I was attracted by the fragrance and beauty of a woman's body, but what are those so-called attractive features? They are simply a false covering created by illusion.
Okay, and this brings us to a very interesting verse here, 19 and 20. One can never decide whose property the body actually is. You ever think about this? This is mentioned also in the 10th canto. Does it belong to one's parents who have given birth to it, to one's wife who gives it pleasure, or to one's employer who orders the body around? Is it the property of the funeral fire or of the dogs and jackals who may ultimately devour it? Is it the property of the indwelling soul who partakes in its happiness and distress? Or does the body belong to intimate friends who encourage and help it? Although a man never definitely ascertains the proprietor of the body, he becomes most attached to it. The material body is a polluted material form heading towards a lowly destination. Yet, when a man stares at the face of a woman, he thinks, what a good-looking lady. What a charming nose she's got. And see her beautiful smile. please scroll ahead to 25. There's more, you know, blood, pus, and urine. We'll skip that part. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, having thus chanted this song, Maharaj Puru Rava, eminent amongst the demigods and human beings, gave up the position he had achieved in the planet of Irvasi. His illusion cleansed away by transcendental knowledge, he understood me to be the Supreme Soul within his heart, and so, at last, achieved peace. So in its criticism of this material attachment between man and woman, it's important to note that the song here of the Ayla king, Puru Rava, is not critical of dharma. It's not critical of marriage in the proper sense. See? So devotees who may not be so mature might tend to extrapolate from this, okay, so any kind of marriage is just another stool, pus, and urine affair, and symptomatic of illusion. See, and this is the wrong attitude. In the Gita, Krishna says, "Kamo smi baratar shabha." Right? I am sex, which is not contrary to religious principles. So these are very vivid portions of Srimad Bhagavatam condemning illicit sex. And sex without responsibility. So, on the other hand, dharma, a dharmic marriage, is a great asset for spiritual life. And it's important that we take the proper lesson from this chapter. Okay? So let's just scroll ahead, please, to verse 29, and then we'll call it a class. Here's the Pala Shruti for this chapter, the blessing. Krishna says, whoever hears, chants, and respectfully takes to heart these topics about me becomes faithfully dedicated to me and thus achieves my devotional service. Arivo. Okay, any questions? Yes?
Comment?
We have a question first. Okay. Questions trump comments. Go ahead.
So what is the difference between the story of Avadhut Brahman and Avanti Brahman? Like, what in the learning, what do we learn from all these three different stories? Why there are three different? Yeah.
The Avanti Brahman was particularly instructive on the subject of being detached from what people think. It also has the quality of the financial loss. You know, that differentiates it from the avidut. Yeah, avidut was also detached, but it was not emphasized so much how people abused him. The same abuse is heaped on another personality from the fifth canto. Anyone remember who that is? Yes, Maharaj Shashadev, the same kind of abuse. He responded by just becoming very indifferent. And this is that's why he's one of the exemplars of the Jain faith. Yeah. Okay. Is that all right? His comment, Naveen? Okay, he's restraining. Okay. Hold that. Any other questions or comments?
I can make one small comment.
Please.
There's a verse in the Gita where Krishna talks about how everything's unmanifested in the beginning, just manifest in the interim, and then unmanifested at the end.
Yes, it's to that Sankhya.
228, I believe, yeah. Avyaktadini bhutani, vyaktim madhyani bharat, avyaktanindananyeva, tatraka paridevana. What need is her lamentation?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Things are just around for a short while. Very good. That's an excellent point. Yes.
I just make a comment on the concept in the beginning. You were talking about how not seeing people as the cause of your suffering. I just heard an example of that from a lecture from Radhanath Maharaj, where he gave the example, if the mailman comes to your door and gives you a bill that is too high and you don't want to pay it, and then you get really angry at the mailman and start beating him up, where the mailman had nothing to do with it, he just delivered. It was, you've made the purchase, you owe the money, it's your karma to pay the bill. It has nothing to do with the mailman.
Yes. Our mailman would be particularly unappreciative of coming to Krishna. That's a very good example. Yes, we should not hate the agents of our karma, it's said elsewhere. So if it appears that somebody is abusing us or dissing us or being rude to us in some way, for us to get angry at them is a symptom of ignorance. This is the point. It should not be. It will not bring us any kind of satisfaction. What was it Lakshmimani said? It's like, I'm going to kill you by drinking poison. Instead of taking responsibility. That's the path to saintliness. Just accept, no, I'm responsible. It's not anyone else's fault. I take responsibility for my own suffering.
But I think that philosophy or that understanding of karma can easily sort of abuse, that the philosophy itself can be abused to justify the so I think I was talking to you recently, but then I just recently read this book by ex-Guru Kuli called My Karma, My Fault. And basically, that's how he perceives that the adults or the devotees justify what he feels as the abuse he experienced as a child. And so I'm just wondering if you could comment something about this danger.
This is to be applied by adults within oneself. If somebody else is telling us it's your karma, then that is not a saintly response to another person's suffering. Okay? I remember I was going through a trauma in my life once, and I went to a godbrother, Garuda Prabhu, in fact. And I said to him, I guess this is my karma. And he said, you don't really believe that, do you? And I said, no, I don't. So, and he said that because there was something I could do about it and had to do about this particular situation. So if we use that as an excuse for inaction or we try to apply it to others, then we haven't understood. It's only within ourselves that when we are in a situation that we absolutely cannot change, it is much better to accept as a reaction to one's past activities than to blame somebody. As we read in the first canto, in the conversation between Maharaj Parikshit and the bull, remember, Kali Yuga is beating the bull. Maharaj Parikshit comes on the scene and said, "Who is doing this to you?" Which is a very strange question, because it's right before, the guy is standing right there with a club in his hand. But he says to the bull, "Who's doing this to you?" And then the bull says, "Well, it's very difficult to understand how it is we suffer. Some people say it's destiny. Some people say it's our own karma. Some people say it can't be explained. What do you think?" Now, you know, what would you or I say? "It's him, it's him." But he refused, and so because the bull refused to blame Kali, Parikshit Maharaj said, "Oh, you are religion personified, because you refuse to blame someone else and thus share in the karma of their sin." That's the thing. If we blame somebody, then we get the same reaction that they get for doing us wrong.
I just want to know, like, who are these people? You know, I mean, that seems really elevated. I don't hear anybody talking like that. You know, I mean, I just, like, I almost can't even, I mean, I don't even think anybody would understand that, you know? I mean, I try to appreciate it.
That's a very good question. Let's think about it while we say. Sarira vijajal datendriya tahi kal jive pile visaya sagare karma jaya jivayati lobamai sadurmati taki jeta katina samsare krishna bodhadoyamo kori bari jiva joy swa prasad anade lobai sanam rita pao radha krishna gunagal premidako chaitanya nitai danimai jainitai shila prabhupad ki jai. So the question is, who is actually able to do this, right, and forgive or to not blame other people who appear to be the agents of our suffering or the cause of our suffering, okay? And the answer is that only very highly realized devotees can do that. It is one of the most difficult symptoms of advancement in spiritual life to be able to forgive other people. And for those who are interested, by the way, there is a free teleconference phone-in seminar this evening between 7 and 8 presented by the Vaishnava Family Resources at VaishnavaFamilyResources.com on the subject of forgiveness. It's specifically for marriages because carrying around the hatred and anger and resentment we have towards other people just poisons our lives. And, Varshana, to answer your question, it's those people who realize how they are hurting themselves that practice this. Once we realize that we're only hurting ourselves by blaming other people, then we stop doing it. Because we're just allowing, allowing very negative feelings to fester in our heart. And we're not getting rid of them. So the only way to get rid of them is to take responsibility. No, I'm just getting what I'm due. And through that agency, be able to forgive the other person. See, forgiveness is not for the forgivee. It's for the forgiver. Oh, you're doing a wonderful job. Go ahead.
Okay, because then we come back to maybe, like, say, when you know, I was in Los Angeles, and, you know, there was this second generation issue, and those kids were so angry. And it's one thing to be, you know, abused and say, "All right, it was my karma." But if you are a child, or in my own experience, I have been very, very ill in my life. Like, my body wasn't put together right. So it's like, you know, when you're sick, you know, I know my guru was saying that, you know, you can't always communicate properly.